You've probably heard of Which Magazine, our home of hard-hitting journalism and informative stories delivered directly to our members. There's our travel, money, and tech mags too. But did you know you can hear some of our best articles for free, available to listen to whenever you like? Each week on the Which Shorts podcast, we bring you a specially selected story, lovingly voiced and produced especially for you, on a whole range of fascinating topics. Just search Which Shorts wherever you're listening.
When life gives you questions, which get answers.
Welcome to the Which Money Podcast, your weekly hit of money news and personal finance hacks to help make you better off. I'm Harry Kine, sitting in for Lou Cheer, and here's what's coming up this week.
Well, for most pensioners, there's been some bad news in that their council tax would have gone up, broadband, mobile phones, so they'd have taken a bit of financial hit right now in April. But there is good news as well in that the state pension has gone up by 8.5%.
But for those customers who've got a fair bit of money tied up in the property, it can be an excellent option. And it does mean, of course, that the payment of the debt doesn't occur for many years to come into the future.
This week on the podcast, we're looking at pensions. We've just started a new tax year, and that means changes to state pensions. We'll have all the details, as well as looking at how you should be thinking about what kind of pension you need, plus what other options are there for retirement if you don't have a pension. To bring us up to speed on all of this, I'm pleased to say I'm joined by Which Money Pensions writer Paul Davis and Andy Hutchinson from Hub Financial Solutions, a partner of Which who provide equity release options. Hello both, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Andy.
Okay, we're going to start off with you, Paul. Can you talk us through what's changed in the new financial year? How much have state pensions gone up by?
Well, for most pensioners, there's been some bad news in that their council tax would have gone up, broadband, mobile phones, so they'd have taken a bit of financial hit right now in April. But there is good news as well in that the state pension has gone up by 8.5%.
Which is fairly substantial.
It is. So I'll come on to that later with the triple lock. Mm. But if you're on the full level on new state pension, your weekly amount is now £221.20, or the equivalent of £11,500 per year.
Very nice.
If you're on the basic state pension, the weekly amount is £169.50 or just over £8,800. When I say the new state pension, it's not all that new. It actually came into force in April 2016, mm-hmm. but there are still two different systems. Those who qualified before April 2016, we call the basic state pension, and then the new, inverted commas, state pension.
Those are the younger pensioners.
That's it. And even though I've just outlined the headline amounts, it's even more complicated in that you won't necessarily get that set amount. It depends on various factors before you qualify for the state pension, including how many national insurance years you had, whether you were contracted out of the additional state pension, which used to be a secondary state pension that people could qualify for, which will eventually die off. And eventually, probably in 20, 30 years, everyone will get those set amounts. But you've got this sort of complicated dual system running at the moment, which means, as I say, you won't necessarily get those headline amounts.
And with the state pension system as it is in 2024, is it a fairly easy thing to claim? Is that a kind of automatic process, or do you have to still head to the post office and get this manually?
You don't get it manually anymore, but it's slightly misunderstood in that people think that they automatically qualify for the state pension, which isn't the case. So you'll be notified a minimum of 2 months before your state pension age that you're due to get the state pension, and you'll get something called an invitation code, which is a... it's a numerical code mm-hmm. which you use in your application process. And then you can go online, you can phone up the pension service, or you can email the service and actually apply. And as part of that process, of course, you'll give them your bank or building society details. And then when you're due, your payments will automatically go into your bank account. So there is no traipsing down to the post office anymore to collect your pension in that way.
So it's all nice and easy for your pension birthday. Presumably, if you think that you should have received something and you haven't, you're worried it's got lost in the post, is that gov.uk probably the best place to go to?
It is. You can go to gov.uk. You'll be pointed in the direction of the pension service, which is the particular department that looks after the state pension. But there's plenty of information online on the way you can chase up if you feel like that the process isn't going as it should, or your payment's being delayed.
Right, so 8.5% increase, that's a pretty sizable amount given the rate of inflation at the moment. This is down to the triple lock, am I right?
You're correct. It's called the triple lock guarantee, and it was brought into force about a decade ago by a previous government. And so it actually means that each year the state pension will rise by either the inflation rate, earnings, or a minimum of 2.5%, whichever is highest. Mm-hmm. So say, if you remember the days when inflation was low, say yeah. inflation was 1% and earnings was 1%, you still get that 2.5% minimum kicking in. So yeah. So pensioners are guaranteed at least a 2.5% increase.
And so when we've had the kind of record high inflation, or record for my lifetime anyway, inflation, that has left it at a very high level relative to that 2.5% that we might have seen in the past.
Yeah, that's correct. As I say, 8.5% this year. Last year it was 10.1%, wow. which was designated by the inflation rate in September 2022. So when inflation was really high around that level of just over 10%, that was obviously detrimental to most people, but mm-hmm. it was used as a metric to increase the state pension last year. And this year, earnings have rebounded. So that 8.5% has meant that pensioners have got another increase that's quite substantial.
It's a bit of a kind of political third rail, the triple lock. If that's stuck around for the foreseeable, what do you see as the kind of the future for pensions?
You're right. It's an area of huge debate, and the Institute for Financial Studies has estimated that it will cost between £5 billion and £40 billion extra to the government if the triple lock stays in place to 2050. Of course, that's a bit of a guesstimate in mm-hmm. that you can't tell what's going to happen to inflation or earnings. Yeah. But if you're talking £5 billion as a minimum at a time when the government is trying to juggle its finances, it's a huge commitment to maintain the triple lock. But with an election coming up, it's obviously very popular with pensioners mm-hmm. and the power that the grey vote has. So already the parties are coming out and saying that the triple lock will be retained and it will be in their manifesto. So much debate about the triple lock, whether it's fair on the younger generations or not, mm-hmm. but it looks like it's here for the time being.
And then I suppose the billion-dollar question, as the IFS has kind of raised, is that sustainable when we have a situation of maybe looking to get rid of national insurance, we've got an ageing population? Is that going to be possible to keep a triple lock in place?
Getting rid of national insurance, that's an interesting proposal. Mm-hmm. And obviously it was mentioned in the spring budget. It would mean a huge restructuring of the state pension system and how benefits are paid, really. Figures show that there's expected to be 25% more pensioners in 2050. So we've got an ageing population. And there's a bit of a misunderstanding in that some people assume that when they pay national insurance, is put into a national insurance fund mm-hmm. for their future state pension. So they're almost paying for their future state pension. That's not quite the case. The workers of today are paying the state pensions of today. So the money collected via national insurance and other taxes is used to fund state pensioners. When those workers retire yeah. and become eligible for the state pension, it will obviously be the workers at that time that will have to produce the taxes to make sure the state pension can be paid. And if you're talking about a smaller workforce mm. and a bigger number of pensioners, that causes problems for governments.
So at the moment, I'm paying essentially my grandma's state pension through my national insurance. But when I get to her age, I'm not sure that I will have quite enough workers there kind of backfilling that role for me, I suppose.
Exactly. You're doing a great job for your grandparents.
Thank you very much.
but when you qualify for the state pension at 85 and it's £5 yeah. a week, you might feel like you've had the rough end of the stick.
Should have had more children, clearly.
Exactly, that's the only way.
So with that, as you mentioned, you know, the idea of that pension age changing over time, we've seen that over the last few years. There are, you know, debates and protests across the world about what the state pension age should be. What are we currently looking at right now for that in the UK?
So the current state pension age is 66.
Yeah.
It was equalised for men and women a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's going up for both men and women at the same rate. It's rising to 67 shortly between 2026 and 2028. And again to 68. It's currently legislated to happen between 2044 and 2046. So a way off.
Yeah.
There's been two state pension reviews in the last 7 years, and both have concluded that that needs to happen sooner.
Right.
The current administration has said, okay, we'll look at that again in a couple of years. They've kicked it down the line because it's so contentious and it's not something they want to get deeply into at the moment. But you can see the direction of travel. It's, as I say, it's already legislated to go up to 68, but how soon that happens is the question there.
So for those who are thinking this seems like a long, long way away, that 68 seems very late to be retiring, how can they pull a pension that's not the state pension? They're presumably having to rely on private pensions. Someone in my position, I'm 31, what should I be thinking about with that?
So we've spoken about the state pension. The alternative is private pensions. Mm-hmm. And over the last couple of decades, we've all been encouraged to look at our private pensions.
And when you say alternative, are people, can you have both or is it one or the other?
Sorry, yeah, not alternative. Mm-hmm. But, you know, eventually you'll get to the age where you qualify for the state pension. You'll have both, hopefully.
And you can supplement that with whatever you've saved in your private pension.
Exactly. But as you say, people won't necessarily want to wait to 67 or 68 to get the state pension. There are some figures released today, actually, looking at healthy life expectancy, which said people, you know, by the time they're 63, could have long-term health conditions, may not be able to work. So, you know, you might not be able to work past 60. So with all the will in the world, of working to later in life, you might need to stop work and depend on your private pension till your state pension kicks in. If you're not working for any reason or self-employed, there's various personal pensions or something called self-invested personal pension, whereby you have more control over the investments that you choose and how much you put in. The government will still add to contributions in terms of pension tax relief, whether it's a workplace pension or a personal pension. So there's that added benefit, as well as the fact that your money will be invested and hopefully will build up over the years. In the stage where you're building up your pensions, you ought to look at workplace and private pensions. But obviously then you get to the stage of retirement, and then you want to make your savings work for you and take some income. And so there's various options there in the way that you take your income.
And so how might you do that once you've reached that time when you want to start taking money from your pension?
Okay, so the main three options is something called pension drawdown, where you keep your money invested. So it's not too different to having your money in the pension in the first place, but you can obviously access the money. You can take money out, pretty similar to a bank account, but it's still invested, so it's going up, hopefully. And then it's up to you to take out money in a sustainable way rather than take 50% a year, and you're pretty soon got an empty pot. So it's being sensible about how much you take. The second alternative is something called an annuity, where you trade in your pot of cash for a guaranteed annual income. So say you're 65 and got £100,000 in your pension pot, that will equate to about £6,000 a year at current rates. So it's almost like it's a bit of a bet on how long you're going to live, to be honest.
So if you're feeling healthy, you've got another 40 years ahead of you, then an annuity means that you've got that fixed rate for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and if you live for another 30 years, you're in credit, and it's a good option. If you die after 5 years, or the house wins in a way. But there are some options whereby your estate can get some of the money back, or your spouse can get, say, 50% of the annuity rate for a certain number of years. So the money doesn't disappear completely. So that's an annuity. And the third way is, since pension freedoms came in a decade ago, you can actually cash in your pensions entirely.
So the full pot that you've got in there.
Yeah, which again isn't the most sensible move for many reasons, in that you may fritter it away on beer and fags.
65, buy a Lamborghini all in one go.
Exactly. So there's making the money last, but also taxation comes into play.
Right.
So if you're above the tax-free threshold of £12,570 per year, and that includes all your income, so you might still be getting money from investments or part-time work, for example. So you'll start paying 20% above that level of £12,500, and if you go above £50,000, say you had lots of sources of income, then you're paying 40%.
Right.
So yeah, again, if you've got £100,000 pot and you cash it in one go, a big chunk of that you're going to pay 40% tax on.
If you don't have enough in your pension pot but you want to retire, do you have any other options? Well, when we come back, we're going to look at equity release and whether your home could help fund your retirement.
2023 was momentous in the fight against fraud. It saw the passing of the Online Safety Act and the Financial Services and Markets Act, both of these happening after years of exhaustive campaigning from us here at Which? But the battle against scams is far from over. Stay in the know and avoid falling victim to scammers by joining over 450,000 others who have signed up to our Which? Scam Alerts. To sign up, head to which.co.uk/scamalert today.
Now, we've talked a lot about pension pots, but if you haven't saved enough, you've got many years of work left, then one option people might want to consider is equity release. And so we've got Andy here from Hub Financial. Your company offers equity release options. Can you explain how they work?
Yeah, so essentially equity release, if we were taking the example of a lifetime mortgage, would be a way of unlocking the money that's tied up in your property and effectively retaining ownership of the property, but borrowing a sum of money which is not then repayable until either death or long-term care. So for a lot of customers who are in a position where they need to raise funds, it's a very easy way in the sense of not having to go through rigorous lending checks and credit checks and all that sort of stuff. So in other words, you're not being judged on your levels of income. But for those customers who've got a fair bit of money tied up in the property, it can be an excellent option. And it does mean, of course, that the payment of the debt doesn't occur for many years to come into the future.
And is that something where you need to have completely paid off the mortgage on your property, or can those who are still paying off their mortgage get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So in order to be eligible for equity release, you would have to have settled up your existing mortgage, but that can be done simultaneously with an application. So you wouldn't have to have done that in advance of approaching us to take out a lifetime mortgage, but it would need to be settled up in tandem with that. So that's, I suppose, one of the key eligibility criteria elements. And also, there's a lot of focus on the property type. So the vast majority of properties will be absolutely fine in terms of meeting the criteria. But some of the more unusual types, maybe construction-wise and also location, may be subject to additional sort of more scrutinized lending checks.
So don't rely on trying to get this sorted with your houseboat or a cave property or something like that. But for your standard three-bed semi, you're more than likely.
Yeah, absolutely. Brick construction properties, even older grade two listed properties, generally speaking, they'll be fine. Lenders, by and large, on equity release are looking at the ease of which the property will sell again in years to come. So, a lot more focus on the property versus a conventional mortgage, where, of course, there's a lot more focus on eligibility around credit worthiness, age, levels of income. Those factors don't really come into it with equity release.
So those are the kind of aspects that you're considering. What should people who are looking at equity release as an option, what should they consider, and what are the kind of pros and cons to this compared to, say, trying to just sell your house and downsize or any other option?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question, that, because, I mean, we've talked about eligibility in terms of where the lenders are coming at it from, but then you've got the suitability factors. So that's very much where we come in. So timing and alternatives is the key consideration point there. So for those customers who may be looking to release funds because they're thinking very much of the future, investing the money, putting it into the bank, that's generally not what equity release is about. It's about really for specific spending objectives. But those spending objectives can be spread over a number of years. So, you know, if the need is an ongoing one, maybe over 5, 10, 15, 20 years, the plan can be set up in accordance to ensure the customer can withdraw the funds in over stages of time over many years, and that can be quite advantageous. But in terms of pros and cons, just covering your question, the vast majority of customers in England and Wales and Scotland are going to be eligible. The money is payable tax-free. There's no impact on income or capital gains tax. If the debt does ever exceed the value of the property, customers are covered by what's called a no negative equity guarantee. So that's factored in on all regulated lifetime mortgage products. But I suppose the main perk of obtaining funds in this way is the fact that there aren't any mandatory repayments to make. So you're not going to be judged on your ability to pay a certain amount back over your lifetime. And the debt would then, of course, roll up. Now, that's a negative, which we'll come on to in a moment. But of course, it does mean money can be obtained without compromising your financial position on an ongoing basis. Things to watch out for, and picking up on that point there, which, like I said, one of the good things is you don't have to make any interest payments between now and when the plan's paid back. But of course, if you don't, then that will be a cumulative interest effect. So we're very, very careful with customers that we go through a very rigorous example with them to illustrate a worst case scenario that if the plan runs for X number of years, this will be what the debt's grown to. And of course, that leads into another risk. Of course, we don't know how long potentially the debt will run for, because of course, it is a lifetime debt. But other factors would be state benefits. So for those customers who are receiving state benefits, I think it's really important to be aware of how releasing funds could impact on that. Because the last thing we would want is for customers to do this and then realize in a year's time when they're reassessed, they've lost their benefits. That we can work around that in terms of ensuring the money is released in stages to keep within the threshold. So that can be worked sort of in tandem with a customer who is on benefits. But we'll also do a benefits check to make sure that those customers who maybe are not getting the benefits they should do are sort of pointed in the right direction there. And I suppose the other drawbacks with equity release, if I'm being quite transparent, is exit penalties. So if you want to pay it back voluntarily, there are fees to come out, albeit they're not as onerous as they were maybe 10, 15 years ago. Customers need to be aware of what those costs would be if they are in a position to pay it back in the future. And there's also upfront fees. So we would generally say allow for about £2,000 upfront in fees, which our fee for advice would be £1,100. And you've got to allow for about £700-£800 for the solicitor as well. But those fees can be payable on completion, so they can be worked into the loan amount rather than having to be costed out up front.
Oh, that's good. So for people who might, are thinking, this sounds great, but I don't want to kind of leave some kind of complicated administrative burden after I've gone to my children or people who are inheriting in the will, is that side of things fairly straightforward as well? There are any complications there?
No, it's a good point. I mean, we would always recommend, and in some instances, insist on third-party involvement. So if there are beneficiaries involved, I think it's important to get them involved in the process where possible. But a lot of customers may well have already had those discussions. And I suppose in terms of the long-term sort of legal aspect there, there really isn't really any further complications, because the debt itself would take precedent over how a will is read. So as long as customers are aware that if the property is worth, say, 200,000 and the debt, say, worth 50,000 on death, then the 50,000 is paid back first and the remaining 150,000 is then just distributed in line with the will. So I suppose the big consideration point is those affected may receive less than they would have otherwise. But in terms of the process, we would always reassure beneficiaries that lenders will work with them. They, as the family members, will be in the driving seat of getting the property on the market, getting it sold for the right market price. So you're not going to have lenders interfering and taking over the process during that period between death and when the debt needs to be paid back there.
If people are, they're listening to this, they want to find out more, they want to maybe follow up as an option, what should be their first steps? Who should they be speaking to?
Well, I think they should be calling into us here at Hub Financial Solutions. I'm more than happy to give our telephone number now, if this is the right platform for that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, so Hub Financial Solutions, we can be reached on 01737 827 949. What we would do initially, the team that would take the call would go through some sort of basic screening questions. So the first thing is just making sure eligibility, the basic eligibility criteria is met. So customer details, will be taken, but skeleton customer details and property details as well. And then assuming where the conversation then progresses, we would then dearly like to get an appointment booked in the diary for you to speak to one of our financial advisors, one of our equity release advisors. And that can be done over the telephone, face-to-face, or on video link. And as I said earlier, if family members do want to get involved, we can do conference calls and get them involved as well. The aim then is to firstly establish if equity release is right for the customer. If it's not, we will gladly tell you so and walk away and give a very specific reasons why. But if we're in a position where obviously equity release is right, recommendations will follow, and that will give you ample time to read through it, get family members involved again at that stage. We can email recommendations over to anyone else, but we would give you the ample time to work your way through the paperwork before making a decision. And then if an application then goes in at that stage, probably looking at about 6 to 8 week lead-in period between application and completion.
If you're like me, you know, you're a little bit younger, you think, I am going to live and work forever. I would rather have my money put into something else. I would like to take all of my wage rather than having any of it going into a pension pot. What would be your pitch to us foolish young people that it is worth putting your cash into pension?
Well, initially, I'd say that you have to be realistic, and mm-hmm. there's loads of pulls on your money, and you know, when you're 25, going out and spending it on holidays and beer is more appealing. But the mantra is start as early as you can, and you know that's sensible, because with investment returns and compound interest, the money will build up. Mm-hmm. You know, you can put it away, and of course there's spells when the markets fail a bit and it goes down, but you know there's so many bits of research that prove over the course of 30-40 years investments do better than any other alternative in terms of property or keeping it in savings. So you know that if you start early and put in as much as you can, it will build up to a sizable pot over time. There's now a system called auto-enrolment, where you're automatically enrolled into a pension mm-hmm. By your employer. You can opt out. I'd say never do, mm-hmm. because, for the reasons I've just given, in that it's, you know, your minimum requirement is 4% of your pension. The employer has a minimum of 3%, lots pay more. Mm-hmm. And then of your 4%, the government will add an extra percent. So for every pound you put in, it will cost you 80p, it costs the government 20p as a way to encourage people to save into a pension. So, you know, all those reasons added together make it quite a compelling mm-hmm. case to start putting money into your pensions.
Another thing that kind of changes things for young people is that more and more we have just so many different jobs over our lifetimes. So many, not just jobs, but different careers. You go from place to place. The average is 12 jobs in a working life. How do you then keep track of all of these different pensions that are scattered all over the place?
Well, keeping track is a problem. There's something in the pipeline called the Pensions Dashboard, mm-hmm. Whereby you'll be able to go online and look in one place to see where all your pensions are. So you can keep track of how much money is in your pensions and which investments you've got. And also the aim is to put a state pension forecast in there, so you can anticipate how much state pension you're going to get.
I'm hearing a lot of aims and plans and targets there.
Yeah, it's been in the pipeline for nearly a decade, and it's been pushed back and back. You know, it's something which has really campaigned on, and we push forward. The hope is that the next deadline is October 2026.
Right.
So in the next couple of years, there needs to be lots of work done to make sure it's delivered. But just the convenience, you know, will act as an incentive, because people can see, mm-hmm. you know, people can add up their pots and think, well, I've got that much, that feels not enough, I need to, you know, look at my pensions.
I mean, I know I've got a load of pensions in various different places. I've got a load of passwords and you know, usernames, and I will hopefully there will be a pension tracker dashboard to make that easier. For now, I have no idea where they are. Say I wanted to kind of make that a bit simplified now, could I try and consolidate some of that money, those investments, into a single pension?
You can. You'd have to do the heavy lifting, to be mm-hmm. honest, and you know, liaise with the pension providers. as long as it was a pension with low charges and all the investment choices you want, it's worth considering consolidation. Mm-hmm. There's counter arguments in that separate pots have separate benefits and investment approaches, so you're almost spreading the risk a little bit.
Many baskets, many eggs.
Yeah, so that's another argument. Something else that's been discussed at the moment is called a lifetime provider. Mm-hmm. Again, it harks back to your point about having so many jobs and so many pots everywhere. And the government's considering that you just have one pension pot that you start off with.
Right.
And when you move companies, you almost take that pot with you, and so that the new company will start paying into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
So much more convenient and not chasing around all those different pots. I guess the red flag there is that you need to be sure about the pot you start off with or the provider you start off with, because if you make the wrong choice at that stage, then you're just sort of doubling down and putting more money into it as you move around. But it's just a proposal at the moment.
Yeah.
I can see that being talked about for years because it is such a major change.
Yeah, it does seem like it's a slow moving area, pensions, when it comes to big changes.
Yeah, absolutely right. And as we said, dashboards, 10 years. And, you know, I've been looking into pension companies that still do stuff by paper. You know, you put paper applications in. You know, it's not exactly moving fast in the sector.
Well, I've got now the frustrating "it depends" question for you here. But how much should we be thinking about putting off our salary into a pension so that we have some money to spend in our twilight years?
Yeah, the $64,000 question, and that's not the answer, by the way. But it's sort of how much you can afford. Plus, you know, if you do get a pay rise, if you get a bonus, if you get an inheritance, say, there's much more exciting ways to spend your money. But, you know, putting that money into this pot that's sort of turbocharged for the future is definitely a good consideration. The PLSA, which is the pensions body, has just updated its figures saying that a single person will need £14,000 per year to cover essentials and £30,000 a year to cover a moderate lifestyle when you retire. So if you're thinking that, you know, you need to fund £30,000 a year just for a moderate way of living, the targets you need in terms of size of pot are quite high. So it's, yeah, put money in when and if you can. Never opt out of any pension, you know, options, because it's definitely not in your favour.
Excellent. So if people want to find out more, whereabouts should they be heading online to read your work?
Well, at which.co.uk, there's plenty of advice and guidance in our retirement and planning section. So in terms of how much you need to save, how you need to get on and apply for pensions, and what you need to do when you come to retire. So we've got it all covered.
Well, thank you both. This has been a great discussion. Paul Davis from Which Money and Andy Hutchinson from Hub Financial Solutions. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, a huge thank you to Andy and Paul for coming on the show today, and to you for listening to this week's episode of the Which Money podcast. If you enjoy today's show, please hit subscribe to make sure you catch our new episodes as soon as they drop. And for your daily money news and advice, you can find us on social media at Which Money and online at which.co.uk/money. We also have the free money newsletter. It's absolutely fantastic. Delivered to your inbox every Monday. It's got our very best stories. Sign up at which.co.uk/money-newsletter. This episode of the Which Money podcast was presented by me, Harry Kind, and written by Adrian Bradley, produced by Adrian Bradley, and edited by James Rowe.
It's Grace here to tell you all about our new podcast at Which. It's called Get Answers, and you can listen now on whatever platform you like. Me and co-host Harry will be with you every other Monday, with episodes dropping each fortnight as we help you solve life's everyday problems. Whether it's getting the most from your weekly shop, finding travel hacks to save on your family holiday, or simply learning the tricks that make your everyday life easier. And we'll be joined by the very best experts too. Just search Get Answers and subscribe so that you can catch our episodes as soon as they drop.